Hey, everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Corner Office Podcast. We're going to pull one out of the archives this time, and we reached, honestly, pretty far back for this one. In 2007, I talked to a guy who had, at that point, somewhat recently become the CEO of one of the best-known companies on the planet, Bob Iger, about a year and a half or so into his run running Disney. Just to give you some context here, Iger was at ABC starting in 1974, moved up the ranks to become president and chief operating officer there. He stayed when Disney bought ABC in 96, and a couple of years after that, Iger became COO under then-CEO Michael Eisner. I was talking to him, remember, in 2007, before Steve Jobs died, although Disney had by that point acquired Pixar, one of Iger's early moves. Netflix was just starting to play around with streaming, but the business was still mostly DVDs. Hulu, not really available to the public yet, and nobody was talking about the content bubble. Maybe because in 2007 we were talking about a housing bubble. I don't know. So there's some context, and yes, it was a long time ago, but it is kind of cool to hear just how Bob Iger was thinking about his job running that company at that time and what the company has become since, really. Anyway, so here you go. From 11 years ago now, my interview with Bob Iger, president and CEO of the Walt Disney Corporation, some of which I will tell you, you are hearing here for the very first time.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Bob Iger, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
What's your first memory ever that you can think of about the Walt Disney Company?
Well, I was an avid fan of the Mickey Mouse Club. I was born in 1951, and I remember vividly watching a black and white television in my house, you know, back before I was 5 years old. So I certainly, I'd say, remember that more than anything, but I also remember being taken to the movies by both my parents and my grandparents to see Peter Pan, Cinderella, Snow White, all memorable.
What is the Walt Disney Company for you? Is it an entertainment company? Is it a technology company? Is it now some hybrid of the two?
No, I don't really think it's either. I think clearly we're in the entertainment business and we use technology for a variety of means, which I hope to get a chance to discuss with you. Very important component, really, of our business. But people make a connection to Disney at early ages, as I did, watching television and going to the movies. In some cases, if you're fortunate enough, visiting our theme parks. And the connection is profound and typically memorable. And I think because of that, Disney is much more than just an entertainment company or a technology company.
When you got this job, bearing that in mind, when you got this job, was there a little element in the back of your head that said, oh man, don't mess this one up?
Well, no, not really. Not quite in those words, but was very, very aware of the very special place that Disney occupied in people's lives, in society, in culture. And I had a strong sense of responsibility.
It's not like running an office supply company or a car company even.
Well, I never have, so I can't compare it at all. Although I imagine if you're running General Motors or Ford or something that is so part of people's lives and culture, there might be some similarities. But Disney is very special. When you mention Disney to people, they typically have an immediate reaction that's visceral, that is typically to something that, as was the case with me, they remember experiencing as a child.
I'm not sure what this says, actually, but when I told my kids I was going to come talk to you, I have three little boys, and they were all a little bit gaga over the guy who runs Disney. Does that make you sort of stop and go, wow?
It does. It does. You know, I take the responsibility very seriously. I consider myself incredibly fortunate, not just to have the opportunity to be the CEO of a large company, but to have the opportunity to run the Walt Disney Company, to be part of a group of people today and in the past that create experiences and entertainment that is just truly memorable.
Are you having fun?
I am. I'm having a lot of fun.
you are still really kind of a new CEO when you think about it. It's not even been yet 2 years. Where does that put you on the scale of experience? I mean, you've been around Disney and ABC for a long time.
I have. I started at Disney with their acquisition of Capital Cities ABC and over a decade ago. And I started at ABC 33 years ago. So many of the businesses and the fabric of this company is sort of very much a part of my own life from a business experience perspective. But what I like about it is that there's still a newness to it because the businesses are so dynamic, because while the fundamentals remain the same, there's also a lot of change in these businesses. And so even though I've been around for 33 years, there's something very fresh about the experience. In terms of being CEO, what I found most interesting is how much there is to learn still. And I like that very much. So even though I've been at this now for almost 2 years, which maybe in some respect is a long time, there's still so much about it that's a learning experience for me, and I like that.
You made a couple of moves right off the bat that generated a lot of attention, a lot of interest, and made people say, look at Disney and Iger and what he's doing. And I'm talking about the deal you made to get your programming on the iPod, and the fact that you now stream online some of your most valuable properties. Did you come up with those ideas, or did that sort of bubble up from the business development types in this shop?
Well, a lot of these sort of big strategic moves are the result of my articulating a strategic direction or a vision, and then a lot of very experienced, very talented people figuring out ways to fulfill that vision. And it becomes very much a joint effort in that regard. I think one of the things that becomes very, very important for a CEO to accomplish is a strategic vision, and then to enable people by creating the right environment to carry it out. And it becomes also important to articulate that vision often, because it won't get carried out unless it's both clear and well spoken. In those instances, they were very much the result of the strategic vision that was outlined, which in those cases was to use technology to reach more people more often in more convenient ways, to really think of the consumer and the power or the authority that the consumer has in today's digital world and serve the consumer better. And so in both cases, I was sort of certainly a driving force behind those moves, but not the sole force or the sole developer of the ideas.
Did you pick up the phone one day and call Steve Jobs over at Apple and say, listen, Steve, I have a great idea?
No, he actually called me months and months before, and he wanted to talk about the notion of creating a television-like side to iTunes, a place that people could go to find TV shows on top of music. And coincidentally, I said to him, well, we had been thinking about possibly creating the same thing, that it was complicated, but very much something that we wanted to accomplish. And he said, well, let's talk. And then one thing led to another, including my becoming CEO and the discussion on Pixar, which was actually totally unrelated. But when I was named CEO-elect, so to speak, Steve and I talked a lot about the future of the relationship between Pixar and Disney, and we got to know each other better. And that actually helped advance the dialogue on the Apple side as it relates to iTunes as well, and vice versa, interestingly enough.
When you increase the consumption of your programming, there are a lot more people who want a finger in the compensation pie. How do you satisfy everybody, from advertisers and marketers to writers and directors? I mean, they're all going to want a piece of the revenue that you guys get from streaming and from iTunes.
Typically in these businesses, when you do the right thing, which means when you make the right product and you do the right thing in terms of the consumer and you distribute it effectively, whether it's at a movie theater or on sale at retail DVDs or you're making available in new digital platforms, there is ample room and ample ability in a way to sort of feed the mouths of the many entities that actually go into the creation of great stuff, great content. So while there are different issues that we need to tackle as the world moves more digitally, in the end, I'm very confident that the industry and Disney will figure out how to accommodate basically all the people that actually created value in the first place by creating the content.
Do you think you've put Disney in the early adopter category of people who are acknowledging the consumer power that exists in the marketplace today?
Disney acknowledges the consumer power in the marketplace today. Where that puts us in terms of the rest of the world or the industry, I'm less concerned. It was a real priority of ours to focus on the consumer. What digital technology has done, it's created a huge power shift or authority shift from the creator and the distributor, the old world, to the consumer, the new world. And while the creator and the distributor still have ample say in how things are made and how they're distributed, the fact is that the end user, the consumer, has a lot more say than ever before, a lot more authority. And if you ignore that change or you ignore the consumer, you get a result like the music industry results, which is that a lot of content lost value because of the way the consumer was accessing it. And entities emerged, in this case really iTunes and Apple, where value actually shifted from the creator and the distributor to a completely new entity, the creator and the old distributor.
Right, but you're at a touchy space now where you're moving toward distribution on, just as an example, iTunes. People pay $1.99 a pop to get Desperate Housewives, right?
But not a bad deal.
Not a bad deal, but a single night broadcast of Desperate Housewives probably gets way more revenue for you than you're ever going to get at $1.99 a pop from 1.5 million downloads.
Correct.
And how do you – where's that balance, right?
Well, if you since you use Desperate Housewives as an example –
not that I watch.
A successful TV series will produce between 22 and 25 episodes each season. And the committed or the avid viewer of that series in a given year will probably watch somewhere in the neighborhood of a third of all those episodes because of other choices lifestyle-wise, meaning you're busy, you've got other obligations, or other choices in terms of consuming media or spending your time. And if we could figure out ways, which we are starting to do, thanks again to digital technology, to engage these people more often, to get them to consume more, because we're creating either convenience or a different price-to-value relationship or making use of a new technology, then we actually will grow our business instead of in any way decreasing or diminishing our business. So a lot of these initiatives, the one you just cited, iTunes and the $1.99 episode, or what you mentioned earlier, streaming on ABC, are actually designed to create incremental consumption, to give people who may not have a chance to watch as many of these programs as they once did to watch more, instead of to shift their viewing from the, I'll call it the initial airing that creates the most value on ABC to a secondary consumption form that may create less value. And so far, while the results are still relatively new to us, because this has only been going on for about a year, what we're seeing is, in fact, incremental consumption and not a cannibalization of the initial form of consumption.
Speaking of streaming, by the way, and us watching more, Disney has announced they're going to be launching their own streaming service coming to you sometime in 2019. Original movies, television shows, probably, I would say, a Star Wars series. And yeah, they were one of the leaders of streaming back when I had this conversation with Bob Iger, but you got to admit, the field is more crowded now. Let me get back to the other big deal that you made happen shortly after you took the CEO's job in this company, the acquisition of Pixar. Heard a great quote from you. It was a video clip, and you said the company was fully valued when you bought it. I mean, you paid $7.5-ish billion for that company, and we don't really know yet how it's going to work out for you. How's it going so far?
So far, it's been great. We, in buying Pixar, brought into this company a treasure trove of talent, a group of very talented people, from directors to animators to technicians to storytellers to John Lasseter and Ed Catmull. And that talent infused this company with not only more talent, but a creative energy that it really needed. And we're seeing a real increase in both creativity and the energy that's needed for creativity to flourish at Disney. It in many respects, was a shot in the arm, a transfusion of sorts for Disney creatively. It's ignited this company. Also, from an integration perspective, because when you buy a company, there are always integration issues that you have to contend with. It's been very, very smooth. Both Pixar's continued operations as our animation company up north, and then the Disney Animation Group down here in Burbank, which is now under the leadership of Ed Catmull and John Lasseter, which is seeing, I think, a real renaissance in many respects in terms of its animation, its approach to that business.
You were smiling when you said this. Is energy a euphemism for tension and a little bit of competition within animation at Disney?
No, actually, well, there's an interesting school of thought when it comes to creativity that it takes tension or it takes competition. Pixar's approach is really different in that it uses the energy that collaboration creates. It uses many voices to create a perspective and a level of collaboration to actually increase the quality of the creativity and I think ultimately the energy. And so the collection of directors, for instance, at Pixar have always had a say of sorts or have been able to give perspective on the work of one director. And so a director puts his work up in front of other directors and gets a level of feedback that is very, very valuable. And without really a tension or a competition, because it's just a way of life, it becomes a way of life. And we're doing that now at Disney. We have a film coming out in a few weeks called Meet the Robinsons. And the director, Steve Anderson, showed Meet the Robinsons in an earlier stage to a dozen Pixar directors, half a dozen Pixar directors, and got very valuable input. And that created an energy with Steve, both an energy that comes from, in effect, affirmation or endorsement of what he was doing, but also an energy that comes from a form of criticism from your peers that can be, when articulated well, very valuable.
You are the man responsible for the financial health of this company, yet you depend on a creative staff whose job is to basically come up with ideas out of thin air to generate that financial health. How do you keep an eye on the creative staff while at the same time maintaining this company going forward in a profitable direction for its shareholders?
Well, it takes a balance. I actually
he says, smiling again.
Well, I like that dynamic or kind of combination of responsibilities. I remember when I became president and chief operating officer of then Capital Cities ABC back in 1994, and Tom Murphy, who was my boss at the time, and introducing me to the board of directors, told the board that I was comfortable in the boardroom or the control room because I had spent a good part of my career working at ABC Sports under Roone Arledge and then running ABC Entertainment in prime time. And I had exhibited in that period of time, at least in Tom Murphy's eyes, some real instincts creatively, but I also spoke the creative language in many respects. I was comfortable in creative processes. I was comfortable in the creative world while at the same time balancing good business judgment and an interest in business and also accepting the responsibility that's incumbent upon people in jobs such as mine today or in my job back then. And in many respects, I bring that same balance to this job at the Walt Disney Company. And if you were to take a look at my calendar on a given day, you'd see a real blend of interaction with business and creativity. Today being a great example of that.
Well, let's talk about that. What's your average day?
Well, the nice thing is that there's no such thing as truly an average day in the sense that no 2 days look alike, but I guarantee they will be filled with a variety of subjects, partially because of the variety of businesses that we're in, but again, because of the nature of a job like this where you're the real steward of a brand, for instance, and the responsibility incumbent in that position, the taste and the creativity and the definition of product that bears the Disney name, in effect, sort of a subject matter or a position that I find myself in quite often, while at the same time making big business decisions. And I'll be going from this interview to a meeting about creative direction and some new creative ideas for a theme park.
Do you find yourself refereeing in the creative process?
No, I don't look at it as refereeing because that suggests a contest or a fight in some form. I view myself as someone who vets other creative ideas. We often make decisions in jobs like this about how to allocate our capital. It's probably one of the primary responsibilities of a CEO. Where do we spend our money? And decisions have to be made from a capital allocation perspective in terms of what creativity to spend it on, for instance. And I do find myself at times rendering opinions or making decisions in that regard, but I wouldn't call it a referee at all.
What's the worst part of your job? What do you wake up in the middle of the night thinking about?
I actually sleep well. I think that's probably the result of being confident that this company is really run by a collection of very able-bodied, very talented, very committed people. And in effect, I know the Disney Company is in good hands. And in effect, I'm in good hands in ways. So I don't lose sleep over anything, really. I would say that the most important thing for this company to achieve is a level of constant, high-quality creative output. And if there's any stress or any concern, it's always that you're making great stuff on a regular basis. And really, that's it. I don't think there's anything else that I really worry about.
From what I read, you don't sleep much. Did I read someplace you get up at 4:30 in the morning to exercise?
I do. I get up on a daily basis at 4:30 because I like to both get my exercise in and do some reading, mostly for pleasure, before I basically hit the books. And by getting up early, it enables me to manage those interests and desires and also give me time to spend running the Walt Disney Company and time to spend with my family.
You have two young boys. What are the limits on their consumption of Disney entertainment at the Iger household? Because my kids, it's an hour on Saturday mornings.
Well, we put limits on how our children spend their time, so they don't get to watch much TV during the week. We have let them recently use their computers more often, which has been a learning experience for kids and parents alike in the Iger household, because I'm struck by the fact that they're turning to their computers more and more for entertainment than certainly I was aware. But there are limitations, less so on weekends, but they're not big TV viewers during the week because of the time constraints that are created by their parents.
If you had to pick a part of this company that its reputation rests on going forward for the next 10 or 15 years, what would it be?
Oh, I'm not sure that there's really one. Anything that bears the Disney name, whether it's a movie or a major division, bears also a very, very high level of responsibility with it, because we take the Disney name very seriously. What it evokes when you say Disney is something that has created real value in the past and will continue to. So I don't think it's about one business, but I'd say the Disney brand is probably the most valuable, most important asset that we have.
Do you view yourself as a guardian of that brand? I mean, does that come with the keys to the executive suite?
Very much so. Very much so.
What don't you know right now about the entertainment industry in the next 10 to 15 years?
A lot.
Yeah, it's a tricky question.
Well, I'll tell you what I do know. What I do know is that quality counts, that there's probably nothing more valuable than quality, that in a world that continues to provide more and more choice for people in terms of how they spend their leisure time or their money on leisure activities, and I think that dynamic is only going to grow, meaning will become more apparent. I mean, choice will proliferate. I think a flight to quality or the importance of quality will only grow. So I know that. That's not going to disappear. If anything, it will become more important. I also know that no matter how the world changes, people will still want to be entertained. And I'm smiling a bit because in 1955, Walt was asked to write some words to be put into a time capsule in a building in New York. And he was asked to, at that point, project what the world might look like 50 years from then. And so 1955, he jots down a few thoughts. We're not sure whether it ever ended up in the time capsule, but we have those thoughts. And in 2005, 50 years later, they were given to me. And he talked about this very point, and that is that no matter what the world looked like, no matter what was available to people, they still would want to be entertained, to essentially take them out of their daily frets. He used the word frets as a for instance. I think at the time he actually said they would want to be entertained and refreshed. He used that word. I think at that point he was actually thinking about the park experience. Disneyland opened in 1955. I guess that he thought about refreshments as well. But I think that will be true 50 years from now, that no matter what the world looks like, people will have a daily grind and daily frets and daily challenges and issues, and entertainment will remain a vital part of people's lives, as it was 50 years ago and 150 years ago and probably 1,000 years ago.
Do you have to run this company with an eye on the past while you're thinking about life in a world of ones and zeros?
I think the past creates value, but I don't think you necessarily run a company with an eye on the past. I think there's a danger in doing that. I think you learn from your experiences. So the extent the past creates value, it's to enable you to learn from your hits and your misses, really, your successes and your failures. But because the world is changing, there's more of a need to be forward-thinking, to look to today and look to the future than to look back. Looking back for us is important because it's important for us to respect the name Disney, what created all the value, the place that Disney has in the hearts and minds of people around the world. But to look back in a way that might be more reverent, or to look back in a way that in effect has you focusing more on what was instead of what is and what will be, I'm not sure that's necessarily productive.
What do you do to unwind, other than wake up at 4:30 in the morning and have some Bob Iger time?
Well, I like the movies. I like to watch TV. I like to listen to music. I like to take advantage of, the various entertainment that's available to us. I unwind exercising and have a few hobbies here and there too, but
what are your hobbies?
I also have children that enable me to unwind in different ways.
So are you one of those guys who plops himself in front of the TiVo at Thursday at 9 o'clock? or do you get those now? Do you get those in advance so that you know
Grey's
you can
Anatomy
watch it when
is
you
on
want?
Thursdays at 9. I have access to getting a lot of product in advance. So much of it that it's almost impossible to watch everything, and certainly impossible to watch everything in advance. So I tend, to varying degrees, to watch things as they occur. Grey's Anatomy is one that my wife and I particularly enjoy watching together, to the point where if we're not in the same town when it airs, we figure out a way to get a copy of it, or we stream it on ABC.com or watch it on iTunes and like to watch it together. So last night's a good example. We watched Grey's Anatomy from last Thursday night last night because we were not together last Thursday.
So you take care to avoid all the spoilers, right?
Yes, exactly. I don't ask questions. Please don't tell me I'm going to watch.
All right, so there was a lot going on in there, but I'm just going to mention this. Grey's Anatomy, still on the air. It's been on the air on ABC since 2005. A whole lot more from Shonda Rhimes at ABC, including a Grey's Anatomy spinoff called Private Practice. Obviously, Scandal, which only just wrapped up. How to Get Away with Murder as well. Although, Shonda Rhimes went to Netflix last fall, which was announced a week after Disney had said they would be launching their own streaming service. So, lots going on in that space.
Let me get back to the Pixar deal for just a minute. Pixar has had an unbelievable string of success. 7 for 7, I think it is. The next one's coming out this summer, Ratatouille, about a rat, basically, in France. What happens if Not just any rat, right? Some gourmand of a rat. What happens if somehow, now that Disney owns Pixar, that film isn't as good as the other 7?
Well, it is. It's not going to happen. Ratatouille is a great film.
What if it doesn't break the records? What if it doesn't have the run that Monsters, Inc. and Cars and Toy Story and all of those films had?
The earth isn't going to in any way fall or whatever the expression is not going to stop its movement around the sun. I think the world of Ratatouille, and so it's sort of it's a difficult question to ask because knowing the movie the way I know it and seeing people's reaction to just the pieces of the film that they've seen convinces me that it's going to be 8 for 8.
So. I don't even know if it's done yet. Have you seen the whole thing?
I have not seen the whole thing in its most in its absolute finished state because it doesn't exist. Yeah. But momentarily it will.
What is the best creative thing you've ever done? The thing you're most proud of creatively?
Wow, that's a very difficult question. I've had the luxury over the years of being involved in a lot of creative successes and creative failures. I'm not sure I could single it out. I think what's most interesting for me creatively is the opportunity to work with some of the world's most creative people over time, and the chance to talk animation with a John Lasseter, for instance, or sports program production with a Rune Arledge. We did work with Steven Spielberg, George Lucas. The list is pretty long, as you'd expect. But I don't know that there's one thing I could single out. There have been a lot of things that I've been involved with over the years that have been incredibly satisfying.
Is there one thing that sort of made you as a creative person that people said, oh, wow, Iger did that. Let's hire him.
Well, the one thing that I recall people mentioning, they mentioned because of my willingness to take creative risks. And when I was programming ABC back in the early 90s at programming in prime time, we had had a lot of success with some real commercial product, great comedies. Roseanne was on the air and ultimately Home Improvement, America's Funniest Home Videos, for instance. And the network was prospering largely because of shows like that. And then we put on a show called Twin Peaks, which, interestingly enough, ended up being a failure. Although in my mind, it'll always be chalked up as a real success because it was an example of trying something new. And in a way, it's really what I think is probably most important about creative processes, and that is there's no such thing as absolute failure. You know when you're involved in creative processes, there's bound to be there's bound to be failure. There are bound to be things that don't work. But in a lot of cases, if you've really tried valiantly, if you've tried with something that's good and something that's different and it hasn't worked, in a way, that's more success than a failure.
You get credit for trying.
That's what Twin Peaks was.
Was there something about you that made the board of this company 2 years ago say, you're the guy?
Well, it wasn't my hair. You'd have to ask the board that question. They had a rather thorough of course, in my case, it's easy for me to say, effective succession process, which gave them access to a number of candidates and gave them a chance to make the decision based on a lot of factors. And in my case, they knew me because I had been president and COO of the company for 5 years. And I certainly had an opportunity to talk to them about my vision and my thoughts regarding the future of the Walt Disney Company. But I doubt it was one thing. I'm sure it was a combination of factors.
Was there ever a time in that long process you thought about chucking it and saying, forget it, not worth it?
As I said at the beginning, having the opportunity to run the Walt Disney Company is rather special life experience. And at the point that the succession process unfolded, I considered the possibility of getting this job very seriously and with great enthusiasm, even though it certainly was not a foregone conclusion. And so, no, there was never a time. I was close enough to it to really want it, and with that desire came basically an unwavering pursuit of it, even though, it was thorough, which I guess in some cases is a euphemism for long. No, there was never a time I thought about chucking it all. It was too good an opportunity not to really go for it to the fullest.
How much do you worry about Wall Street?
I don't worry about Wall Street. I focus on delivering shareholder value, and there, as you'd expect, there are many constituents that someone in my position has to be in touch with, either in touch communications-wise or just in touch in terms of having a sense for what they want or what they need. Our cast members, as we call them, our employee mm-hmm. base is one such constituency. Investors is another. But I don't worry about Wall Street per se, nor do we manage the company with a worry in our mind about Wall Street. We manage the company to create great product and grow shareholder value.
Do you worry about losing that creative edge? Because it seems to me in a creative company like this, the one thing that could do you in really is a wholesale creative collapse. It won't happen tomorrow, but you might.
Well, we have so many different businesses and so many different creative processes that it's very, very unlikely that we'd have a wholescale kind of loss of creative edge. But as I said earlier, the one thing that I want more and more, more than anything, is for a constancy of sorts or consistency of high quality creative output. But I don't worry really about losing it.
Life's pretty good then.
Life's been great. The company is in very good shape. There are constant challenges and goals that we've created that are yet fulfilled, but the company is, I'm proud to say, and certainly glad to say, is very strong, as our fiscal 2006 results indicate.
Was this, you sitting in that chair and running this company, was this part of the Iger plan?
No, not at all. I had a real desire to have a successful career. I started out really wanting to be a television newscaster and spent some time before I joined ABC in 1974 as a weatherman and a feature newscaster, and concluded quickly, thankfully, that I wasn't good enough at it to achieve the kind of success that I felt I wanted. And so I redirected and ended up at ABC and in a production role. But I've never been one that really plan my career out years in advance. I've always believed that you show up for work willing to work hard, you treat people well, you exhibit a passion for what you do, and a commitment, and you succeed. And I'm fortunate that over the years I have been given incredible opportunity, both at ABC and at Disney, that far exceeded even my wildest dreams. And but I certainly never established the goal of becoming CEO of the Walt Disney Company, at least until I had been president and COO of the company and knew that the job would be open and clearly decided to go for it.
Entertainment is a notoriously fickle business, yet you followed a guy in this job who was here for 20-something years, had all kinds of success and all kinds of turmoil. Where do you see yourself 5, 10, 15 years from now?
Well, 15 years from now, hopefully I see myself on a beach.
Oh, I get the age of 70.
Enjoying life, but I don't look that far ahead. We've established a number of goals for this company, and hopefully we're on the right path to fulfilling them. And I haven't created a long-term plan at all. My hope for the Walt Disney Company is that it continues to prosper and that we only grow in terms of the great position that we occupy in people's hearts and minds around the world. But other than that, I don't have a clear picture of what either my life might look like or the world will look like that far out.
I'm not sure how close Bob Iger is to that beach at this point. It's rumored, had been rumored, I suppose, that he would consider running for president in 2020. That seems to be off the table. He's been extended at Disney a whole bunch of times now through, at the latest, 2021, I think. Not clear yet who would take his job when he leaves, which is possibly why the board keeps him hanging around. All right, that's it. A long one, an old one, but a good one. Hope you enjoyed this special from the Archives edition of the Corner Office Podcast. If you like this episode, please do leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Really helps us, especially when you're nice to us. Subscribe as well. Send it to a friend. We just need more people to hear our stuff, man. Corner Office Podcast is produced by Bridget Bonner, although, in the interests of full disclosure, Stephen Gregory produced that interview back in 2007 with Bob Iger. Marketplace, the radio program, is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl, back in a couple of weeks.